Today, 25 years in prison for a miscarriage of justice, but the police still won't apologise. And Zoe Williams on why she loves a Greggs. Before we begin, a warning. This episode includes strong language and descriptions of violence. After spending 25 years confined within the walls of a small prison cell for a crime he didn't commit, Paul Blackburn pays a lot of attention to his surroundings.
Pretty much everywhere I've lived since I got out of prison, I've lived next to water.
Yeah.
For whatever weird reason that happens to be. And now I've got like an estuary leading out to sea at the bottom of my garden. And it's actually being able to, there's a need to be able to see into the distance.
Yeah.
I mean, in my place, it actually steps down a hill and there's pretty much nothing around you, just trees and what have you.
It's very peaceful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Paul was just 14 when a 9-year-old boy was attacked and left for dead by a canal in Warrington, close to where he lived. A year later, he was convicted of attempted murder and remained in jail until he was 40. The Guardian's Peter Walker first reported on Paul's case a decade ago, and it's a story he's been unable to shake.
At the time, I was completely struck both by the appalling injustice of his case, but also by what a fascinating person he was. He is someone who's completely self-educated. He came from a very kind of chaotic background, but educated himself in prison, fought against the system, won this appeal. He's very stubborn, he's fiercely charismatic, he's very, very bright. And I always wanted to come back to the case to see where Paul was now, 10 years on. And I also wanted people to hear his voice, because, you know, written down on the page, his quotes are completely fascinating. But you don't get the full sense of it, of his passion, of his anger, until you actually hear him.
I'd actually spent far, far longer in prison because of my claims of innocence than if I'd accepted that I was guilty. You had a man locked up for something he didn't do for half his life.
10 years on, Peter, now a political correspondent, came to us to say he really wanted to revisit this story. He's gone back to Paul, to his solicitor, to the police, and to the now retired Court of Appeal judge who described the case as a shocking miscarriage of justice. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, after 25 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, will Paul Blackburn ever get an apology? Let's go back to the beginning. 1978, Paul was 14, from Warrington, from quite a disrupted home. How were things going for him then?
Not that great. I mean, he freely confessed his background was a very, very chaotic one.
A lot of violence in the house. You know, the stories of my little brother John being pulled out of his pram and thrown at the wall, you know, to that sort of level.
At the time, he had convictions for burglary and arson. And he was living at this reform school, the Borstal, which is like a kind of residential school come prison, you know, which was the case at the time for teenagers who'd done things wrong.
And one day he was hanging around with his brother with an air rifle. What happened next?
What's never been in doubt was that, you know, on this day in 25th of June 1978, a really, really appalling crime took place. A 9-year-old boy who was fishing on kind of waste ground got taken away by an older boy who was carrying a knife. He got very badly sexually assaulted, he got beaten, he got stabbed, and he basically got left for dead, kind of in this kind of alcove weighed down by boards and bricks. He was in this kind of disused kind of canal area. And basically the attention fell on Paul and also his brother because they were known to come from a chaotic background, but also the fact that they were known to live very close by.
So the police started by arresting Paul's brother Fred, but then they gave up on that and ended up letting him go. After that, they turned their attention to Paul.
They actually apparently said to Fred, it doesn't matter which one we'll get one of you.
He was interrogated by two police officers, two very senior, much older police officers, for more than 4 hours in total.
Where were you? I have no idea. You know, what were you doing that afternoon? I don't know. Sanging about, kicking around. Well, what time did you get up? Tea time. What time's tea time? Well, it's tea time, isn't it?
At the time, he was 15. He just had his 15th birthday. And the only other person in the room was a kind of official from the reform school he went to. So it wasn't, you know, someone helpful, like a kind of teacher or a parent or anything like that. And he wasn't told at any point that there was legal representation possible. He remembers just feeling this incredible pressure and not knowing what the police wanted. They were doing what he kind of called the classic good cop, bad cop thing. One of them kind of really, really pressuring him. The other one saying, go on, Paul, it's all right. Just, you know, tell us.
He was trying to ask me details of what had gone on, and I don't know what to say. Oh, he's buried under bricks. How big were the bricks? Well, I don't know, how big is a brick? And you're actually helping them to construct and build this story. True or not true didn't matter anymore.
And eventually, after 3 hours of questioning, he basically cracked. He said, you know, what do you want to know? And he started to tell them what he thought they wanted to hear.
Which was that he had carried out the attack. Has he explained why he confessed?
He's basically said he just went inside his own head and just wanted to get over and done with. And this is this thing that happens and has been kind of documented lots of times when people are interrogated for long periods of time. And that's why kind of effectively kind of torture techniques, just keeping people isolated and ask them again and again, has been a very kind of discredited thing, because people end up telling their interrogators what they think they want to know.
It's another world. It's something that you can't actually describe, because you're completely and utterly helpless in every way. And it's that kind of hopelessness and feeling of being completely and utterly lost in the dark. And there is no light. There is no way out.
Did the police have any actual evidence beyond what sounds like a questionable confession? Did they have a description of the attacker from the victim?
There were vague descriptions to do with, I think, long curly hair. And Paul's hair at the time of the attack was reasonably long. And one of the circumstantial pieces of evidence was when he went back to the reform school, he asked about getting his hair cut, which the Crown said was, you know, an attempt to kind of cover up the evidence. But that was incredibly circumstantial.
What happened at trial?
He says now he has very, very little recollection of what took place in the trial. He said he was just retreated inside himself.
I'm not too sure how much I was actually with it at the time anyway. I was quite disembodied for it all, really. It was not as if it was actually even really happening to me.
He only met his lawyer once before the trial. He had no idea what defence the lawyer gave him. So it wasn't really a particularly fair trial. The judge basically directed the jury that the evidence of the police was much stronger than Paul's evidence. He was convicted. He was sentenced to life in prison for attempted murder and for the sexual assault. And he basically went into prison, and there he was left.
And tell me about his family. Were they involved in any way? Were they supporting him?
No. I mean, this is an incredibly sad thing about it. The moment he was arrested and charged, he says his family and friends wanted nothing to do with him. So he was left completely on his own. And throughout the trial, he says the first 15 years in prison, he was entirely on his own.
Well, no one visited him.
My friends and family were just shrugging their shoulders. You know, there's nothing we can do. My friends and my family at that time weren't the best people in the world. You know, there's a lot of issues at home. It's like the whole world's against you.
Tell me what he told you about life inside prison.
It sounds unimaginably difficult. Because he continued to insist he was innocent, he refused all the protection in prison you get if you're convicted of a sex offence. So basically he was fair game to be beaten up, to have, you know, his food spat in and tampered with, and he says it was just incredibly difficult.
Gladiator school. Pure and simple. It doesn't mean I'm a gladiator. Believe me, I'm fucking not. It's, you know, beatings on a daily basis, abuse on a daily basis, spit on a daily basis. The first time I was placed on report officially by a prison officer was for refusing a direct order to mop my own blood up off the floor.
And, you know, he says the first 15 years were basically a bit of a blur. He lived inside his own head. He tried to fight against the system, but not really to do anything about the fact he didn't commit the crime.
I suppose more towards the end, I was more able to stand up for myself and prepare to fight back, and so things weren't as bad. but there was never a feeling of this is going to change, this is never going to be any different. I assumed I was going to die in prison, and that was that.
The only way things changed was later on in prison. He was kind of taken under the wing of some older, more educated prisoners who believed he hadn't done it and, you know, kind of helped to teach him, to educate him, and helped him to fight back.
Did they repeatedly try to get him to confess and admit that he'd done the crime?
We asked him when I met him this last time, we were saying, you know, were you ever tempted to confess? And his answer was really, really interesting. He's saying, well, it would have been pointless, because the moment you confess, you then have to go through this long kind of reform parole process of having to explain why you did it, how you felt about it, what the attack was, you know, how you've changed. And he was just basically saying, I couldn't describe any of that because I didn't do it.
How did he eventually get out of prison?
Well, he sought help from, you know, any people who possibly could. He was in touch with the BBC's Rough Justice strand. He was made connections with Glyn Maddox, the lawyer who eventually took on his case, who's an expert in those kind of things. He ended up actually being released on licence as a life prisoner in 2003, 2 years before the appeal court hearing actually took place.
So he spent 25 years in prison, the entire custodial element of his sentence, for something he didn't do, before an appeal process even begins. That seems shocking. What happened at the appeal?
The appeal took place because the then relatively newly created Criminal Cases Review Commission referred it to the appeal court. And the ruling is really, really interesting. The written ruling, which you can still read, basically concludes that the two senior Cheshire police officers who interviewed him, a DCI White and a DI Marsh, when they told the court that Paul had written this confession without any help from them, didn't tell the truth. And, you know, he went through all sorts of evidence from experts about how easy it is for young impressionable people to give a false confession if they think that's what their interrogators want. And also evidence from a linguistic expert who said that, you know, a 14 or 15 year old couldn't possibly have written this. You know, I'll read a little tiny bit from it because the language is incredibly strong. Both White and Marsh said on oath in 1978 that Blackburn had written his confession statement entirely unassisted. Those statements by the officers can now be seen to have been untrue. It's not, you know, the role of the appeal court to say definitively that someone did not commit a crime, but they were very, very, very clear that this, you know, conviction was not safe.
When you decided to go back and see Paul Blackburn again, 10 years on from the last time you spoke to him, you also looked at the people around him, so his lawyer, and also the judge, Sir David Keane, and you discovered that he had recently retired. I mean, did that mean you thought you might get even more interesting stuff from him?
I thought it was worth a go, because when I first spoke to Paul, he was still working as an appeal court judge, and obviously judges cannot really speak on the records, even about, you know, prior cases. So I just sent Sir David a speculative email saying, you know, you might not remember this case and you might not want to talk about it, but, you know, if you do, then here's all my, you know, contact. And he came back very, very quickly saying he remembered the case very, very well. So we went to his house in Oxford, and he lives in this very nice house a few miles away from Oxford city centre. And he invited us in and was incredibly open about it. He was basically saying that this was an appalling miscarriage of justice, one of the worst he could ever remember. And he was adamant about the fact that the police had lied.
I thought it was actually quite a shocking case. And that was my first impression, and it was a lasting impression. It turned out, by the time it got before us, that the police had lied, as the Crown had to admit before us, in asserting, as they did at trial, that the confession had been written by the defendant without any prompting or interruptions from the police officers. I mean, that was manifestly absurd when you had any sort of linguistic assessment of it, because a lot of the phrases in the confession were not the sort of thing that a 15-year-old lad brought up in the Warrington area from a fairly poor background would have been using. They were the typical sort of police bits of jargon and so on.
And did he make demands on the police?
Well, that was the interesting thing, because, again, judges are quite wary of criticising police forces.
In the light of the findings of our court about the way in which some of the officers in that force had lied at trial, leading to a wrongful conviction, I would have thought it would have been appropriate for him to apologise.
One of the very, very jarring things about the aftermath of Paul's case is that Cheshire Police have refused to acknowledge any error. They've refused to apologise to him. He's quite bitter about him. He's, you know, understandably bitter about lots of things. But his subsequent treatment by the police is this really, really sore point.
Why wouldn't they apologise?
It's not entirely clear. When I wrote the first article 10 years ago, I rang them up and said, you know, you've never apologised to this man, why not? And it took about literally a month for the response to come back. And when the response did come back, it was basically saying, well, you know, things were different then. It was like 1978, which Glyn Maddox, Paul's lawyer, described as an excuse, you know, straight out of Life on Mars, you know, which it basically is. You know, saying, well, you know, we did things differently then.
Why did it take them a month to get back to you? Cheshire Police needs a quicker press office.
I have no idea. I was so annoyed by it, I even managed to track down one of the officers. I kind of cast around, there's various websites for retired officers in, you know, various places. And I put out a message. I was trying to speak to either, you know, retired DCI White or DI Marsh about a case. I didn't say what case, you know, and gave my details. And a few weeks later, I got a mobile phone call. I was just in the office. And the moment I said what I wanted to talk about, there was this silence on the phone and the phone went dead. It was quite an eerie moment to have this connection with the person who was responsible for all this. I read into it that someone who's long retired from the police and is presumably enjoying their retirement on a healthy pension doesn't want to be reminded about an enormous miscarriage of justice, which they were a central part of.
And for Paul, he spent a quarter of a century in jail for a crime he didn't commit. How did he find adjusting to life outside prison, age 40?
He found it extraordinarily difficult. He had gone in as an adolescent and was coming out having to learn everything about relationships, about everyday life.
It was far simpler in prison because for me, everything was very, very black and white. I'm innocent, I shouldn't be fucking here, I'm going to fight you all. That's all there was. Coming out here, they're all, you actually feel more of an alien outside of prison than you ever did inside of it.
He didn't get compensation for a certain number of years. I mean, he talks very, very eloquently about the struggle he had because he had this moment of euphoria, particularly when the conviction was quashed. But then his feeling was, now what?
It is strange, really, because, I mean, this is everything you fought for your whole life. And it actually, the euphoria of it is actually as deflating as anything else, because you know it's not going away. It's not going to start again. It's not going to be a brand new future. It's not going to be a happy ever after. And it's not. And it hasn't been. You're still there on your own, completely and utterly isolated from everything.
He's a very, very damaged, you know, he says this himself, he's a very, very damaged and traumatised person, that he can be brought back to his experiences in prison at a moment's notice.
I still get quite distressed on a, you know, almost daily basis, replaying things over and over again. You're standing there doing the ironing and all of a sudden you're in full Sutton in the punishment block. You know, and the sights and the sounds and the smells and everything's all around you. There's different things will set me off. Uniforms, keys, all this sort of thing.
And when you think about these things, is the kind of sense of trauma all the greater? Because also in your mind is the fact that you should never have been there in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. Always. And the fact that there's still so many people there in prison. And probably some of them may never get out, some of them may never win their cases, who've been fighting their cases for 10, 15, 20 years, still there, still fighting. And you, yeah, sometimes feel quite a lot of guilt about that as well. It's not your guilt, but, you know, you can't help it.
And certainly for a long time, he freely confesses he was a very difficult person to be around. He couldn't sit still. You know, kind of girlfriends would wake up to find he'd kind of woken up in the night and just driven across the country.
So find it difficult, even today, I mean, I'll walk from here to town, which can be, you know, 5 or 6 miles, in my flip-flops, just because I need to get out and keep walking and keep moving.
And physically violent towards himself.
I mean, one of the things he was saying in the interview he did just now is that, you know, he's saying it's very difficult, even for his wife, who's known him for a long time, that he can be completely calm 1 minute, and then the next minute he says we'll be actually hitting his head against the wall, you know, kind of making it bleed, because just the trauma is too great.
Clearly, Paul's had a lot of dark times, but you did mention a wife, and I know you spoke to him about their relationship, about having a laugh and just having normal fun days out together. So he has found some modicum of happiness and stability.
This last weekend we were at the Steam Fair. Cool. Bit old codgerish, but yeah, straight on the fun fair. We're all for that. And then she actually won a coconut on the coconut shy. No way! No way! I was throwing balls left, right and centre, never hit a thing. Dink. Coconut. No way!
He very cheerily describes himself now as Dobby the house elf.
What, from Harry Potter?
Yes, because his wife works and he basically minds the house. He does the ironing, he mows the lawn and stuff like that. You know, one of the interesting things was that when we were talking to him, you know, we were asking, can you see a future for yourself? And he said, in the past, I could never, ever see what the future was. And now he says he's just happy to grow old with his wife.
Future. Growing old with my missus. That's it. I don't want anything else. Really. Really don't.
You mentioned that Paul didn't get compensation at first for this terrible miscarriage of justice that he went through. It took a few years. But eventually, he did get compensated. Has that been significant for him?
He eventually got compensation. It's not a massive sum. It's in the hundreds of thousands of pounds, I would guess. It was enough for him to buy himself a home. So he has got somewhere to go to.
It made a big difference to me. You know, I own my own house. I have somewhere to actually go, somewhere that is mine. Most people never actually get that. They were chaotic before they went into jail. They were chaotic when they were in there. They're going to be chaotic when they get out. For me, it's actually allowed me to be that chaotic without being on the streets.
When Paul got that money, there was a presumption in the law that if you had been wrongfully convicted and sent to jail, that you were entitled to compensation. But that changed in 2014, didn't it, under the Conservative and Lib Dem coalition government?
The rules have changed. Glyn Maddox, his lawyer, was saying to me that the rules are now so tough that now to get compensation, even if your conviction's been quashed, you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt you did not commit the crime.
Wow, that is quite something. I mean, that seems to contradict the very idea of innocent until proven guilty. And it's almost impossible to prove a negative. I mean, you'd usually need DNA evidence. So look, you've been looking back at this case because it's one you've not been able to shake for 10 years. You've gone back to Paul. You've gone back to his solicitor, to the appeal court judge. The final piece of the puzzle is the police. I know you didn't have much luck last time. Did they get back to you quicker this time round?
No, it took them even longer this time. It took them 4 months to get a statement back.
4 months.
And I was hopeful that their view might have changed because I was saying to them, not only is this very, very clearly a terrible miscarriage of justice, but the appeal court judge, you know, which is something which is they very, very rarely do, has said you really, really should apologise over this. But they eventually got back to me and they're not going to apologise.
What are they saying?
They sent me quite a long statement in the name of someone called Assistant Chief Constable Matt Burton. And in some ways, it kind of gives some ground. It says we're concerned he serves a term of imprisonment. We recognise, you know, the Court of Appeal found a conviction wasn't safe. One of the slightly concerning things that they've always said is that they are satisfied we do not need to reopen the investigation. And basically, if you're Paul, you know, reading that, and, you know, he said that to me in the past, that basically he thinks that means that they think that he actually did the crime, that they think they got the right person. But the rest of the statement they gave me basically says more or less what exactly they told me 10 years ago, that, you know, this was a different era. Investigations were done in a different way now. It wouldn't be done, you know, in the same way. But they make no mention of saying any apology.
didn't expect an apology from. Never expect anything from them at all, because nothing will ever change.
I mean, given what he's been through, there is nothing that will, you know, as it were, make things right for Paul. He is very, very plain that he's bitter at the way the police feel. And an apology would not in any way make things right, but it would be the very, very basic thing that maybe the police could do.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Peter Walker, who began reporting on this 10 years ago. You can see the links to that original reporting on today's podcast page at theguardian.com. Coming up, why Greggs is sharing all the dough. Now, employees at Greggs are being rewarded with a share of a £7 million special bonus after the hugely successful launch of its vegan sausage roll last year, which I have to say is amazing. Guardian columnist and food writer Zoe Williams loves everything about the bakery chain. Well, apart from its vegan steak bake.
I think the best way to go into Greggs is with a really bad hangover that's completely stopped you being able to eat anything for like 18 hours, and then suddenly your appetite comes raging back. And it's just, that's just an incredible experience, incredible experience of being human. And I cannot imagine the food critic who wouldn't agree with that. This is obviously a great year for Greggs, 7% rise in sales. And that has, in large part, been put down to the sales of the vegan sausage roll, which were astronomical. They've distributed some of that to their staff in the shape of a bonus, which I don't think the staff were expecting, but certainly no one watching was expecting it. I've got to say, the vegan sausage roll is a really good baked snack. It tastes as much like a sausage as anything that isn't a sausage is ever going to taste. What more could you ask? And I'm not sure whether you'd call it a health snack, but if you're a vegan who isn't in the mood for a health snack, I can't think of anything better. Probably the past half decade has been characterised by this culture war. You know, you're either authentic working class or you're metropolitan elite. You're either pro-Darlington or you're pro-Dalston. You're either a vegan or you like eel pie. It's like this kind of really intense perceived division between one type of person in the culture war and another type of person. And Greggs, I think more than any other chain, basically said, absolutely no way. We're pro-Darlington and pro-Dalston. We're pro-vegan and we're pro-nacho slice. You know, they really just completely rejected the idea that they had to pin their colours to one or other of these caricatures. And it's just a real relief. This bonus was not mandated by the contract. It was not mandated by a PR disaster. It was not done to cover anything up. It was a genuine human response. We've had a really good year. Let's give some employees a share in it, which I think is really unusual. You know, I'm prepared to stand corrected and maybe it's got some nefarious intent, but I don't think it is. I think they have got a real commitment to their staff. I think someone who's never been to a Greggs is doing that on purpose, right? They're doing that to make an original opinion, and the original opinion is, I've never been to Greggs. So I think they just need to get over themselves. It's not original, it's annoying.
That was Zoe Williams. Do read her writing about Greggs and much more on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Paul Blackburn, Peter Walker and Zoe Williams. This episode was a big team effort, produced by Josh Kelly, Nicola Kelly, Brenna Daldorf, Courtney Youssef and Gregory Robinson. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.